I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Just ahead, listeners chime in on what's right and what's not with this program on Back Talk. But first, it's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop. They talk about what's in the news and whatever's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week are opinion writer and blogger Jimmy Israel, BET Vice President for Digital Media Nick Charles, Justin Ross of the Maryland House of Delegates, and Ruben Navarrete, a syndicated columnist. Let's see. I hear they want to talk about Don Imus' reported return to the airwaves, former heavyweight champ and Mike Tyson snack Evander Holyfield's return to the boxing ring, also a little bit about reality TV. I may jump in and ask the guys about my chat with Ms. Hollander. I want to hear some male perspective. But for now, take it away, Jimmy.
Hey, thanks, Michelle. Fellas, hey, welcome to the shop. How are we doing?
What's going on, man?
Jimmy, good, man. Good.
Great.
All right, well, let's tune right in talking about shock jock Don Imus. Now, he's negotiating a deal with Citadel Broadcasting that will put him back on the air on December 1st. Now, this after he was fired in a media storm for referring to a girls' college basketball team as nappy-headed hoes. Now, you know, the National Association of Black Journalists, they were at the vanguard getting him removed from his chair, Nick. And was the National Association of Black Journalists, were they right for demanding his ouster in the first place?
I think it was perfect for them because it's been an organization that's been so stale, so moribund, so irrelevant for so long. So they got something to do. My thing about it, NABJ needs to keep pressing because, you know, they have, it's like a dog with a bone between its teeth. They need to keep pressing and saying, hey, let's watch this. Now, if they're going to be a one-trick pony and only going to go after Imus, I have a problem with that.
Wow. Yo, JR, Imus said that hip-hop influenced his views on women. Now, I didn't know Imus was a hip-hop head like that. Did you buy that at all?
You know, I don't know. I never saw him at any of the concerts I was at, I'll tell you that much. But, I mean, right. it probably had something to do with it. I mean, it bleeds into all sides of popular culture. It's not an excuse, but, I mean, it probably had something to do with it. But, you know, and with regard to the NABJ, you know, as long as they keep their eye on the ball, that there's other people out there that are, you know, perpetuating, you know, on a daily basis, steadily getting paid, talking about an agenda that, you know, hurts people of color, then I think it's totally appropriate for them to be talking about this.
Well, my problem has always been, I said from the beginning that Imus was going to come back. And, you know, when you cast journalists as activists, you know, that's when they cross the line. And I think you have to make a decision. Does anybody agree with me on that? Nick?
No, I don't. Because when I think about it, we all bring different perspectives. There is really no objectivity. It's where you're coming from. And I think as an organization, when you represent 3,000 journalists across the country, and this guy comes out of nowhere and goes after a group of women who nobody would have known. They lost the game anyway. Nobody knew about Rutgers and C. Vivian Stringer and Rutgers. And all of a sudden, he makes them the butt of this really bad quote or comment. I think it's right for journalists and for other folks to come out of the woodwork and say, hey, what's going on here?
Let's keep it moving. Speaking of people getting that are the brunt of jokes, some reality shows celebrate groupie culture by putting men and women out there essentially selling themselves for a shot at cheap fame. Now, Nick, BET's College Hill is a reality show about college life at a historically black university, but it was really widely scolded and derided by the alumni. How is BET addressing the critics of this show?
Well, I think, you know, we can do the best we can. And I think you look at College Hill and it represents a slice of life that you never see anywhere. You know, how many people ever see anything about HBCUs, historically black college and universities? The shock to the system is to see these black people from this environment together in one place. Usually when you have reality shows, and of course the real world is the one that started all years ago, is that you see them from different backgrounds, different parts of the country. If you do see people of color, they're from the Midwest or a Big Ten school or from an urban area. Here you have a group of folks who most people have never seen, never interacted with, because, you know, HBCUs for the rest of the culture sometimes fly below the radar. People are like a little taken aback because what they see now is a lack of diversity in this group itself. But beyond that, I don't think there's a problem with it.
Well, yeah, certainly the real world introduced the MTV generation to the reality show. But the first reality show was really The American Family, which aired on PBS in 1973. And it was more like a documentary thing about a family in the throes of divorce. But we've come way, way, way away from that. Yo, Just Blaze, JR, what's the deal? What's the appeal of reality shows?
people would watch anything that was crazy. I mean, if they televised an execution, some people would be watching it. Doesn't mean we should. My kids want ice cream for breakfast. Doesn't mean it's good for them. Well, it's certainly not good for me. You see my figure. I think that's the way it's going. I think there's starting to be pushback. You know, the corporate giants are trying to feed us, and we got to quit buying it. We got to quit eating it.
Ruben, the R, yo, my concern is, does middle America see minorities through this sieve, through this film of reality shows?
If this had only been sort of a white thing and never become a black brown thing, that would have been okay with me. It's funny. This is kind of where I draw the line on the quest for diversity. Gee whiz, white folks are over there eating bugs on a show, and they're like on a desert island. We need to do that too. No, this is something they should have stopped and said, you know what? You have that. You take that. We'll go focus in on, like, you know, IBM and, you know, getting into Yale and stuff. And y'all go. You can have the reality shows. I tuned into the Flavor Flav thing, you know, where brother just trying to find love. There's Flavor Flav, you know, trying to go find love.
Oh, man.
I couldn't turn away. It was a guilty pleasure. I was watching it.
No, is it that's the problem?
I thought, I just don't see the cultural contribution from that show. I just don't think that's
the problem
good way to go.
Nick, go ahead.
Ruben's talking about, you know, the guilty pleasure. My problem is that that's the highest rated show VH1 has ever had. But imagine if that show, Flavor of Love, and the offspring, I Love New York 1 and now I Love New York 2, were on BET. Right. My God, they'd have to shut down the company.
Can I just throw something out here? You know, Nick BET has another show we talked about earlier in the program, Sunday's Best, which is gospel-oriented. A lot of people are hot about it. They think it's...
Exactly.
It's the opposite of salacious, but still a lot of people find it offensive. I think it's not a gospel message.
Well, I think it's because when you start commercializing gospel, and I think, but the fact of the matter is, there is commercialized gospel.
Hmm. By all means, you know, I'm a big I Love New York fan, thanks to my girlfriend, so it's my guilty pleasure, too.
Can I just take a pause here and just say, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. It's our weekly visit to the barbershop. Take it away, Jimmy.
Yo, former heavyweight champ Evander Holyfield is stepping back into the ring on Saturday to try and win a fifth heavyweight world title against unbeaten Russian Sultan Abragimov. Oh, man, with a dame like that, he better be able to fight. Yo, check this out. He's also shilling these Real Deal Grills, a new cooking pan to compete with George Foreman's grill. Now, Ruben, coincidence? Mm.
No, not at all. There's a lot of money in those grills. You know, I remember the story where... George Foreman sold the licensing rights to his name to the grill company for like $150 million or something. It was outrageous.
Wow.
And good for him. And Evander wants a part of that and with his own grill and all this. But, you know, also Evander has like 11 kids and 3 ex-wives. So, you know, he's got to be working. He needs to have some income. This is somebody who used to make $20 million a fight. I'm concerned about fighters who go back in there past their prime. He's 45 years old now, I think. And
he's 44. He'll be 45 not long after the fight. 6 days after the fight, he'll be having his 45th birthday.
I think that's getting up there in fighter terms, and I'm not sure, you know, if fans really get their money's worth.
Right. So. Well, you know, Holyfield was diagnosed with a heart condition in '94, and he said it was cleared up by a faith healer. Now, I wouldn't put too much faith in that. You know, New York didn't put much faith in that because they banned him from boxing ever again because they said he had diminished skills. Now, Nick, why do old fighters come back past their prime in the first place?
They miss the money, they miss the attention, they miss the adulation. You know, the heavyweight championship of the world is the biggest deal in the world. But the only place this man can get license is in Moscow, in Russia. I see visions in my head of Rocky, where Apollo Creed gets knocked out and gets killed by Ivan Drago. Evander could really get permanently damaged. He's already slurring, he's already slowed, and he should not be fighting anywhere. Whoever licensed this should be held, should be held criminally responsible if something happens to him.
Yo, Adrian, buy my grill.
I'm sorry. I know that I'm the girl here, okay? But I don't understand why boxing is legal anyway for anybody. And I don't understand why you protect the hands at the expense of the head.
Well, Michelle, I must disagree. My father was a boxer.
Go ahead, Nick.
I love it. Break it down.
I love boxing. It's a sweet science. My dad used to box. He taught me how to handle myself. And it's a great thing to do. But there's so much money involved in it. And it is exploitative. It's, you know, it's like running like anything else. It's like horse racing or dog racing or any kind of activity where people could get hurt. But also this excitement level is so heightened. But when you see somebody, primarily somebody like Evander Holyfield, who's a proud champion, way past his prime. And, you know, obviously he's fighting abroad because he can't get a license in New York or even in Las Vegas where they can license anything.
I hear you. Right. Well, guys, can I run something past you before we go?
Sure, well.
Yes, it is.
And your show.
Yes, thank you for pointing that out. Thank you. I talked to Xaviera Hollander earlier today. It was the last of a series of conversations I was having all week about this whole question of non-traditional paths to power. Earlier in the week, I talked to some women who are into roller derby and, you know, like knocking down other women on skates. And I talked to Jimmy's personal hero, Corinne Steffens, author of The Vixen Diaries. And I wanted to talk to Xaviera because, you know, she talked in her classic text, you know, The Happy Hooker, which I'm sure at least some of you have dog-eared copies of laying around. Yeah, I know you've heard of it.
I have mine at home.
Yeah. She talked about, you know, how this was empowering for her. You know, she ran her own business. You know, of course, she was a famous prostitute and madam in New York in the 70s. But I asked her, you know, if this were today, women have other ways of being powerful. And this is what she said.
They can be great, but they can destroy the egos of their men. I'm almost for men's liberation. Why should we always be women's liberators? I think women have made it for themselves now. I don't feel sorry for women too much. But men, I feel sorry for the men.
I'm just amen. Saying. What do you think? Ruben, you were saying amen?
Yeah. I could feel like, oh, yeah.
You're feeling crushed under the weight of my feminine power?
Not just you, but my wife, my mother, my sister. There's a myth in the Latino community, and sometimes you hear it in the Black community as well, that you have like these weak and submissive women. I don't think so. I've yet to meet any of them.
No, I've yet to meet any of them.
I don't know. Justin, what do you think?
I appreciate, you know, whatever, but you know, I am woman, see me grind. That's crazy. I do not. There is absolutely.
Hey now.
If it's not, you know.
Free enterprise.
You
hey
know,
now.
Hey, but you know, but for real though, fellas, I mean. For all the daughters out there, you know, we're going to do everything in the whole wide world to make sure our little girls have everything to be have the most opportunity. This lady is talking about a lifestyle which may be making the best of a terrible situation. That's all it is to me.
Hmm. Keep our daughters off the poles.
Off the poles.
Keep the daughters off the poles.
Off the poles.
Go ahead, Nick. You were saying, you know, you understand what I'm saying.
My thing about it is that when women really start running the world, when they start being more than, you know, two or three in the Senate and being more than a handful and running CEO companies, then we can talk about it. Until then, come on, guys. We got it good.
I like that.
Okay, man.
Jimmy. I like it.
Okay, bro.
Jimmy, what do you think?
Well, I have a different perspective. I mean, I'm fighting for custody of my children. And I can tell you, man, you know, men really catch heck in court trying to be responsible for their kids. You know, there used to be a time where they used to have to wrangle fathers to get them to be responsible for their kids. But if you stand up and want to be responsible for your kids, I mean, you have to jump through all kinds of hoops and jump on one foot and scratch your head and sing the national anthem backwards before they even give you any holler at all. And then you're 15 grand in with the lawyer, and you haven't even seen a judge yet. I'm all for men's rights. Word up.
Right. Jimmy, there's a presumption there that women are better, the mothers are better parents than fathers. That's not really fair.
Let's be honest. You know, women, girls are achieving. You look in colleges, you look in high schools, they're outperforming boys. You know, in that respect, maybe there should be a little attention given to what's going on here, that boys can't graduate at the same rate. But at no wholesale level should we be talking about, you know, men are getting the short stick.
With that, we got to call it a wrap. Thanks so much, everybody, for showing up. Got to kick it back to the woman of the house. Michelle Martin.
Oh, thanks, Jimmy. Thanks, Jimmy. And listen, if you need a fresh copy of The Happy Hooker, I can send you mine because I know yours probably worn out, okay?
Love it.
Jimmy Israel joined us from WFSU in Tallahassee, Florida. He's an opinion writer and blogger. Ruben Navarrete writes for the San Diego Union-Tribune and CNN.com. He joined us from KPBS in San Diego. Justin Ross is a state delegate in Maryland and self-described hip-hop head. He joined us here in the studios in Washington. And Nick Charles is the vice president of digital content at BET. .com and the proud new dad of baby Jordy. You can find links to all of our barbershop guests at our website, npr.org/tellmemore. Gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks. Yep, yep.